Good morning. Can you hear me now?
Good.
Okay.
Thank you.
We are here because we are Unitarian Universalists. And we are here because we love being Unitarian Universalists together. Yes. This morning is movie day. As a framework for watching three clips from About Schmidt, I would like to give us just to say a few words about why we're going to watch film clips. First, a brief historical framework. We call ourselves liberal, members of a liberal religious tradition because of historical precedent. 200 years ago, the father of modern Protestant theology, Friedrich Schleiermacher, made personal experience the foundational reference for religious experience and theological reflection. Not God, not revelation, not the Bible, not church history, not doctrine, but a personal human experience. This is why 97, almost universally today, most of us say personal experience is the major source of our religious convictions. This makes us a liberal religious tradition as opposed to a conservative or orthodox religious tradition. We refer to personal experience as the foundational reference for religious experience. Schleiermacher made this link for any number of reasons, not the least of which was that the King of Prussia wanted to bring together the Lutherans and the Calvinists, the Reformed tradition, out of which came for us the Puritans, the Congregationalists, and the Presbyterians. He wanted to bring these two Protestant groups together and create what he called the Evangelical Church of Prussia so that he could have a united religious Protestant kingdom. So Schleiermacher had to write the systematic theology. He could not make doctrine the foundation of this union because what divided the Lutherans and the Calvinists was their doctrine. So that's what divides us, Schleiermacher says. What unites us? He said, the feeling of being inextricably interwoven with all of life, that uplift of feeling, that shift of feeling, such that you have to speak. This feeling of being absolutely united with all is awesome. It's a change of heart, he said. So that's one element of personal experience. How it is expressed depends upon the religious community. So thus, he was just as interested in the atmosphere that we create of care and compassion, such that when the person speaks, the uplifted emotion is changed into a religious sentiment. It becomes Buddhist or Islamic or Unitarian Universalist. And so that's the second element. The atmosphere we create as a compassion takes the change of heart and turns it into religious conviction for our community, which is why our kids are Unitarian Universalists before they know the seven purposes and principles, et cetera, et cetera. Before they know about Schleiermacher. And so the third element is this zone of freedom, this doctrinal freedom, which of course had to be there because he was uniting in this way a systematic theology for two different discrete doctrines. So he called the zone of freedom the null point of consciousness, the place in which there aren't any concepts at all, what is present is the awareness of life itself, all of it. And so the self, the mind, is in a state of awe. It's empty of thought, but full of life. So those are our three elements of personal experience. Change of heart, or the very possibility of it, an uplifting feeling. The atmosphere that's created by a religious community that takes that emotion and changes it into a religious conviction. And that zone of freedom, that doctrinal freedom, such that we can speak and say our own, search for our own sources to explain this extraordinary feeling. In 1961, when the Unitarian Universalist Association was created of congregations, Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations, as a liberal religious tradition that brought together two historically Protestant denominations, the Unitarians and the Universalists, like Schleiermacher, the UUA, and this movement could not possibly say, well, we all have this idea in mind, so we're going to be doctrinal. That's not liberal theology, and that certainly wasn't the UUA Association of Congregations. Not only were the Unitarians and Universalists identified by different theological traditions and doctrinal claims, but by the time we get to 1961, some of the congregations didn't even call themselves congregations or churches or even a religion. So doctrine was certainly not going to be the foundation of our association. It's going to be doctrinal freedom, this zone of freedom, a change of heart, or the very possibility of it, and a religious community, a congregation, a society, a fellowship that creates the atmosphere of care and love and compassion, that takes the emotion or the very possibility of it and changes it into a conviction for that congregation, so that within that congregation you can have atheists and theists, persons who are Judaic and Islamic and Christian, all calling themselves members of the same congregation because their convictions have the same tonality. So, this week, we are on a journey to focus on two of the three elements that are of critical importance to us as Unitarian Universalists when we say that personal experience is the major source of our religious convictions. Shift in emotions, an uplifting shift in emotions, or the very possibility of that. And the atmosphere created by a community that takes the emotion or the very possibility of it and changes it into a religious conviction, a religious sentiment, be it humanist or atheist. We tend not to focus on this emotional aspect of our tradition and of our religious feeling, but rather to simply focus on the doctrinal freedom, which is major. That's why we go to a Unitarian Universalist congregation, because of the doctrinal freedom. But we forget that the other two elements pertain to emotion, the feeling of being inextricably interwoven with all of life, such that we have to speak. One final point. What kind of emotion is this? It's not one single kind of emotion. But rather, for Schleiermacher, it was, as I said, this feeling of being caught up with everything. And I'll give you a very brief example of this, and then we'll get to our movies, our film clips. My mother, who was an artist, as I mentioned yesterday, died of lung cancer. For years, her body was just filled with cancer. Her doctors did not give her chemotherapy or radiation therapy. And her doctor finally said to her, "I don't understand. Anyone with this much cancer in her body would be dead, but you're not even showing signs that you're sick." And she said, "I don't have time to be sick." So when it finally took over, it took her away very quickly. A few days before her passing, the last time she went into the hospital, I sat in her room, knowing that my task was simply to call the nurse whenever she became fidgety, because by then she was barely conscious, never opened her eyes. Call the nurse so that the doctor could come in and give her more morphine, which is, of course, what kills patients at this point. So she started to move around, and her fingers became very nervous, and she clawed at the sheets. So I immediately pushed the button for the nurse to come so the doctor could come and give her more morphine. And then I watched what my mother did, because as I said, she was an artist and she loved life. So her fingers stopped clawing at the sheets, but now very methodically began to fold the sheets together until there were folds. And then with one hand, she took the folded material and held it up. And with the other, she pulled from it a flower. At which point, she raised her weak body from her bed, looked at what she had done, opening her eyes, and she smiled. And then she fell back into unconsciousness. That smile, that glow, that astonishment is the foundational experience. So, why watch movies to explore this? Yesterday, we got on the road, the journey. We began to look at this foundational experience by unbagging our feelings, discovering that there are parts of ourselves that we have forgotten exist, to let them out of the bag so that we could become whole again and breathe deeply again and thus sing, praise the spirit of life, the breath of life, life itself. With this work, we are now on the road. And we now have the spiritual power, the power of life itself, to see beyond our beliefs. Now, Tandeka, what do you mean see beyond our beliefs? We're a non-creedal tradition. Give me a break. I mean the following. And again, I'll use a personal example. My mother and father named me Sue. My mother was 5'5½. I never felt like a Sue. Sue was a fine name, but I just always knew it was not my name. So I tried different names, and finally when Desmond Tutu gave me this name, I knew it was my name. At one point, I asked my mother, who was 5'5", and I'm 5'9", I said, "Mom, why did you name me Sue? I don't even have a middle name." And she said, "Oh, when we found out we're having a little girl, we wanted something short and petite." So when she asked me why I had changed my name, I said, "Mom, you wanted something short and petite, and I'm not short and petite." She said, "Oh, no, 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 we didn't mean you, we meant your name." I don't know. So, Sue was the short and petite girl they wanted, not the one that they got. And I was raised in this way with bagged emotions to be that perfect child. So, seeing beyond belief for me means seeing beyond Sue, my parents' child, to me. Seeing our own feelings. Seeing feelings we aren't supposed to have and bowing. We don't have to act on them, but feelings have to be acknowledged. A Otherwise, quite literally, they'll show up like a heart attack or a nightmare. So, seeing beyond beliefs means not seeing someone's idea, because seven different persons can have the same idea, but the content will mean something different because it's emotional, the emotional content. Seeing beyond belief means seeing how a person feels. And when you see how a person feels, that person is way beyond your concept of the person. Okay, so we're going to watch three film clips from About Schmidt because, for several reasons. One, we will have the same textual reference. So we'll always be talking about something that we've all watched. Two, when we go to a movie, we can't take what's going on screen at word value. Characters will say something, but we know that there's more there than meets the ear, which is why it's a movie. And the director is doing her or his best to get us to see what else is going on, so that we expect something to happen that the characters don't know is going to happen, but we already know it. We think, I knew that was going to happen. And the director does everything he or she can do to get us prepared to see the emotional content of the words. So, by practicing seeing beyond belief, what Schmidt believes to be the case, and what his community believes to be the case, but what really is the case, we practice seeing beyond belief because, as a religious community, this is part of our vocational calling, to actually see you as you and to see me as me and to love every single part of it. Okay, let's begin. Three clips. The first one we're going to watch twice. First, just to watch it, then we'll distribute a handout, then you'll watch it again with a shot sheet. And then I'll simply ask you, what did you see? Let's begin. The first clip is the opening clip of the movie. So even if you haven't seen the movie, you're seeing the movie for the first time. This is what you'll first see. And the other two clips that we will show are self-explanatory, so that even though you haven't seen the movie, there isn't a need for me to summarize it, because you'll get what's going on from the clips, okay? Thank you.
I would just like to say, Warren, that as the new guy taking over for you, I hope I can fill your shoes, because from the looks of the people here and what they think about you, they sure seem awfully big. Well, as most of you know, I just moved here recently from Des Moines with my wife, Patty, here, and Kimberly, our 14-month-old, and you all have just made us feel so welcome. And Warren, I want you to feel just as welcome to drop by the office to visit anytime you want. In fact, as we've been discussing the last couple of weeks, I might have some questions to ask you about our various products, like the new Universal Life policy we're launching next month. And, well, anyway, here's to you, Warren.
Hey, Warren. How do you feel about these young punks taking over our jobs? Seems like some kind of conspiracy to me. Now, I've known Warren here probably longer than most of you people have been alive. Warren and I go way back, to the horse and buggy days at Woodman. But that's ancient history. Anyway, I know something about retirement. And what I want to say to you out loud, Warren, for all these young hotshots can hear, is that all those gifts over there don't mean a goddamn thing. And this dinner doesn't mean a goddamn thing. And the Social Security and pension don't mean a goddamn thing. None of these superficialities mean a goddamn thing. What means something, what really means something, Warren, is the knowledge that you devoted your life to something meaningful, to being productive and working for a fine company. Hell, one of the top-rated insurance carriers in the nation, to raising a fine family, to building a fine home, to being respected by your community, to having wonderful, lasting friendships. At the end of his career, if a man can look back and say, I did it, I did my job, then he can retire in glory and enjoy riches far beyond the monetary kind. So, all of you young people here, take a good look at a very rich man. I love you, buddy.
that on the first page is the shot sheet, so that every single shot from the opening sequence of just the geography of the place is listed, as well as the speech by Ray at the end. Okay, let's begin.
I would just like to say, Warren, that as the new guy taking over for you, I hope I can fill your shoes, because from the looks of the people here and what they think about you, they sure seem awfully big. Well, as most of you know, I just moved here recently from Des Moines with my wife, Patty, here, and Kimberly, our 14-month-old, and you all have just made us feel so welcome. And Warren, I want you to feel just as welcome to drop by the office to visit anytime you want. In fact, as we've been discussing the last couple of weeks, I might have some questions to ask you about our various products, like the new universal life policy we're launching next month. And, well, anyway, here's to you, Warren.
Hey, Warren. How do you feel about these young punks taking over our jobs? Seems like some kind of conspiracy to me. Now, I've known Warren here probably longer than most of you people have been alive. Warren and I go way back to the horse and buggy days at Woodman. But that's ancient history. Anyway, I know something about retirement. And what I want to say to you out loud, Warren, for all these young hotshots can hear, is that all those gifts over there don't mean a goddamn thing. And this dinner doesn't mean a goddamn thing. And the Social Security and pension don't mean a goddamn thing. None of these superficialities mean a goddamn thing. What means something? What really means something, Warren, is the knowledge that you devoted your life to something meaningful, to being productive and working for a fine company. Hell, one of the top-rated insurance carriers in the nation, to raising a fine family, to building a fine home, to being respected by your community, to having wonderful, lasting friendships. At the end of his career, if a man can look back and say, I did it, I did my job, then he can retire in glory and enjoy riches far beyond the monetary kind. So, all of you young people here, take a good look at a very rich man. I love you, buddy.
Okay, good. All right. They have shots of the new construction and the old construction, and it's a period in his life. And so I think that Schmidt is really resisting change and really resisting the fact that he's moved on and does not have something to keep him busy.
So where's the text for the resistance?
The shots of the construction and the shots of the older pictures of him, and the fact that he's handing off his position to someone new.
So the juxtaposition creates the
tension. Yeah.
Okay.
Good.
I like the juxtaposition.
Loud, please.
Like the juxtaposition between the tight head shot of the steer and the tight head shot of Warren as if he were blocked in just like the steer was.
What is a steer?
Piece of meat.
What kind of piece of meat?
Right.
What kind of male?
Yeah.
A castrated male. A castrated male. This is directly speaking directly to the audience.
There was also with that the idea that the steers were prize winning and he was a prize winning employee. He's the picture of American success.
Right. Juxtaposed with the castrated steer.
Whatever he was struggling with, he was struggling with it most as he was walking to the bar. His body was the most stiff at that moment.
So, us, we know about shit what?
Now.
All right. Very good.
That
way. when he was following her in that too, and it was like, that was sort of like, you know, the loss of control after retirement, kind of see it in that man, and his wife was like, you know, killed him.
Okay, so loss of control.
Dear Ndugu. Dear Ndugu. My name is Warren R. Schmidt, and I am your new foster father.
Let's say personal information. All right.
I live in Omaha, Nebraska. My older brother, Harry, lives in Roanoke, Virginia, with his wife, Estelle. Harry lost a leg 2 years ago to diabetes. I am 66 years old and recently retired as assistant vice president and actuary at Woodman of the World Insurance Company. God damn it, if they didn't replace me with some kid who, all right, so maybe he's got a little theory under his belt and can plug a few numbers into a computer, but I could tell right off that he doesn't know a damn thing about genuine real-world risk assessment, or managing a department for that matter, cocky bastard. Anyway, 66 must sound pretty old to a young fella like yourself. The truth is, it sounds pretty old to me, too. Because when I look in the mirror and see the wrinkles around my eyes and the sagging skin on my neck and the hair in my ears and the veins on my ankles, I can't believe it's really me. When I was a kid, I used to think that maybe I was special, that somehow destiny had tapped me to be a great man. Not like Henry Ford or Walt Disney or somebody like that, but somebody, you know, semi-important. I got a degree in business and statistics and was planning to start my own business someday, build it up into a big corporation, watch it go public, you know, maybe make the Fortune 500. I was gonna be one of those guys you read about. But somehow, it just didn't work out that way. You've gotta remember, I had a top-notch job at Woodman and a family to support. I couldn't exactly put their security at risk. Helen, that's my wife. She wouldn't have allowed it. But what about my family, you might ask? What about my wife and daughter? Don't they give me all the pride and satisfaction I could ever want? Helen and I have been married 42 years. Lately, every night, I find myself asking the same question. Who is this old woman who lives in my house? Why is it that every little thing she does irritates me? Like the way she gets the keys out of her purse long before we reach the car, and how she throws our money away on her ridiculous little collections. And tossing out perfectly good food just because the expiration date is past. And her obsession with trying new restaurants.
Seafood buffet. Let's go there Sunday.
And the way she cuts me off when I try to speak.
And she goes ahead and seats the people who came in behind us.
Well, the thing
which
that
normally, now, I wouldn't mind at all.
And I hate the way she sits and the way she smells. For years now, she has insisted that I sit when I urinate. My promise to lift the seat and wipe the rim and put the seat back down wasn't good enough for her. No. Then there's Jeannie. She's our only.